Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Alexander DeSanctis of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Alexander, it's always good to have you with us. Let's dive right into the good news for conservatives. And after last week's omnibus bill, on top of failing to repeal Obamacare in any significant way, other than, I guess, the individual mandate through the tax cut bill, the Republicans doing themselves no favors when it comes to improving their odds for maintaining majorities in the House and Senate following the 2018 midterms. Fortunately, though, they've got the Democrats who are busy shooting themselves in the foot in a number of different ways. And there are new ads out targeting some of the most vulnerable Democratic incumbents. For example, there's one targeting Heidi Heitkamp out in North Dakota because she would not support the tax cut bill. And now there are a couple different ads out targeting Democratic incumbents because of their close ties with Hillary Clinton. And of course, we talked a lot in the last few weeks about her comments over in India about how Trump won the states where the people want to go backwards, and they've got a bunch of racists and misogynists and women who don't think for themselves. So naturally, the Republicans are trying to tie these Democrats to those comments. Here is the National Republican Senatorial Committee ad tying Bill Nelson, the longtime Florida Democratic senator, to those Hillary comments, including a nice clip of Nelson during the 2016 campaign.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
If you look at the map of the United States, there's all that red in the middle where Trump won. And his whole campaign, Make America Great Again, was looking backwards.
Hillary will not only be commander-in-chief as president, but she will be the unifier-in-chief.
The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
And it has words on there about how Florida will remember this come Election Day and so forth. So, Alexander, personally, I think pointing out that Democrats would favor taking away your Second Amendment rights, which we'll talk about a little bit later, and they voted against the tax cuts will probably be more effective than, hey, this person liked the Democratic presidential candidate from a couple of years ago. But as long as Hillary Clinton keeps opening her mouth, we'll take whatever benefits politically might come from it.
I think that's exactly right. You know, Hillary, I think it would be much better for the Democratic Party if she would just accept the fact that she actually did lose and kind of slink away quietly and not keep putting her foot in her mouth. But as long as she does, this is ample material to tie these Democrats to her, especially, you know, in Florida and North Dakota, in these states that went to Trump, and where these, you know, I think there are 10 Democratic senators up in these red states up for re-election this year, and some of them really aren't too vulnerable. Look at Sherrod Brown in Ohio, for example. But in Florida, I mean, Trump won Florida, and that was kind of a big deal. Trump won North Dakota, and North Dakota's not a liberal state by any means. In these places, I don't think voters really liked Hillary Clinton very much at all. And so if their votes are up for grabs, being reminded that the Democratic Party thinks they're, you know, xenophobes and homophobes might kind of push them to the red side even further.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the campaigns play out here, because it's one thing to go after the incumbent Democrats. There's a lot of votes you can point to, and certainly ties like this to Hillary Clinton and so forth. So obviously it's going to have to be a different strategy for, especially on the House side, the Democrats trying to unseat Republicans, especially those who might not have a legislative record of their own. So any ties to Hillary Clinton can be pretty effective. She's the gift that really does keep on giving.
Certainly, especially in those House elections. I mean, I don't know how much the rhetoric will play in with the Republican incumbents, but being able to point to a Democratic Party that hates even, you know, moderate Americans or some who aren't fully on the progressive left might be helpful.
Let's move on to the bad martini now, and we're going to take issue with certain things in the New York Times in our last two martinis today, starting with John Paul Stevens, the former Supreme Court Justice, and he wants to get rid of the Second Amendment. That's always encouraging from someone who's been on the Supreme Court or was on the Supreme Court for 35 years, just wants to trash the Second Amendment. He says, quote, for over 200 years after the adoption of the Second Amendment, it was uniformly understood as not placing any limit on either federal or state authority to enact gun control legislation. In 1939, the Supreme Court unanimously held that Congress could prohibit the possession of a sawed-off shotgun because that weapon had no reasonable relation to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia. Speaking of a well-regulated militia, earlier in the piece, he goes on to say that the fact that we really don't have that anymore means that we really shouldn't have gun rights anymore. He says concern that a national standing army might pose a threat to the security of the separate states led to the adoption of that amendment, which provides that a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Today, he says, that concern is a relic of the 18th century. So therefore, he thinks the rest of it ought to go in the shredder as well, which is evidenced by the fact that in 2008, he was in the minority. It was a 5-4 decision in the Heller case in which four members of the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that individual Americans did not have the right to bear arms. Talking about Heller, he says, overturning that decision via a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Second Amendment would be simple and would do more to weaken the NRA's ability to stymie legislative debate and block constructive gun control legislation than any other available option. So, Alexander, it's one thing when Brett Stevens or other random people suggest this in the pages of the New York Times. When a guy who sat on the Supreme Court for 35 years suggests it, it makes you wonder about his fidelity to the Constitution during those years. We should point out he's almost 98 years old, so the fact that he's able to construct paragraphs is pretty impressive at this point. But what do you make of John Paul Stevens weighing in and saying it's time to just scrap the Second Amendment?
Well, for one thing, it makes me very happy he's no longer on the court and hasn't been for a few years now. But I just find it absolutely remarkable that he would refer to the process of just getting rid of the Second Amendment as simple, as if we can just kind of snap our fingers and off it goes. So obviously this piece was very disturbing. But I also will say it was heartening to me slightly in the sense that he at least acknowledged the Second Amendment exists and that in order to kind of, you know, make room for these sorts of wild gun control proposals that people on the left want to run to at the moment, that we actually would need to get rid of the Second Amendment to do that, which doesn't necessarily seem to fit with his jurisprudence. But the fact that he thinks that is more than some on the left can say, who just kind of want to totally ignore it rather than actually, you know, follow the rules and get rid of it somehow and then move on to this expansive gun control agenda.
Why is it that in this debate, we really don't see this in too many other places in the constitutional debate, that this was what they thought in 1790 or 91, whenever the Bill of Rights got approved by the Congress, but that only referred to then. It doesn't really apply to today, or if it does, we shouldn't go beyond muskets. But yet, obviously, when it comes to the First Amendment, we don't limit the media to 18th century printing presses. So how do they get away with this argument and have people not laugh in their face?
I think a large part of it is that the average person just isn't very educated about gun control policy at all, or the effect, you know, who owns guns, what particular guns do, how we can stop mass shootings. People don't even really know about, you know, the fact that as gun restrictions have lessened over the last 25 years, so has gun violence. The only thing increasing is mass shootings. I think most people probably don't know that. And so when you hear rhetoric like, well, the Second Amendment just applies to muskets, plus in conjunction with your desire to just kind of latch onto the first policy you can think of to that you think will alleviate this problem of mass shootings, then sure, you're just going to justify that with whatever talking points you happen to hear and not do too much research.
All right, let's move to the New York Times editorial. This is from the editorial board. This is back from Sunday. On abortion, while Donald Trump once said he was very pro-choice, since the start of his presidential campaign, his stance on abortion has been consistent. It should be banned, no matter the consequences to women. At times, he has even veered to the right of the mainstream anti-abortion movement, as when he said during a primary season town hall event that women who seek abortions should face some form of punishment. Most anti-abortion politicians profess to want to protect women, even when they pass laws that harm them. Now legislators in one state want Mr. Trump's cruel vision to become reality. Ohio lawmakers have proposed legislation to ban all abortions, period, with no exceptions for victims of rape or incest or save a woman's life. Caring to term a pregnancy against one's will is punishment enough. In fact, it can amount to torture, according to the United Nations Human Rights Council. But the Ohio bill would not only cut off access to the procedure, it would also open the door to criminal charges against both abortion providers and women seeking the procedure. Then they quote an ACLU person saying, well, of course, it's legally unsound, it's unconstitutional, blah, blah, blah. But here's the fun part, because they talk about other bills that have moved back the point where you can have abortions. Mississippi just had one that cut it off at 15 weeks, for example. And the Times says this rash of radically unconstitutional bills is appearing by design. The anti-abortion movement has been trying to pass pre-viability abortion bans like the Ohio bill, hoping that efforts to overturn them could lead to a challenge of Roe v. Wade that would end with the 45-year-old decision's reversal in the Supreme Court. Alexandra, I think they figured out our sinister plan. We actually want Roe v. Wade to be overturned. Can you believe they figured it out?
You know, I'm just imagining a room full of, you know, hard at work investigative reporters kind of on the trail of the pro-life movement running to that editorial board and saying, guys, I've got material for you. We finally figured it out. They want to make all abortion illegal. How, you know, can you believe it? This was their plan all along. You know, the title itself of this editorial is An Ohio Bill Would Ban All Abortions. It's part of a bigger plan. And I'm just wondering, where has the New York Times editorial been for the last 45 years? The goal has always been to make abortion illegal. So even leaving aside the kind of intensely hyperbolic language in this editorial, I just don't really understand what they think the movement has been doing. Obviously, the pro-life movement has always been very open about the fact that these bills are part of an incremental move. And if you push abortion to 15 weeks, you know, limit it at 15 weeks, then suddenly you wonder, why are we drawing the line at 15 weeks? And people think about it and realize, hey, maybe it's impossible to draw lines on the humanity of an unborn person. And maybe we shouldn't be in this business at all. So clearly that's always been the end game. So for them to portray it like this, I think is very disingenuous.
Of course it is. And then they end the editorial, Alexandra, where they always end on this issue. But they actually use a quote from Trump from years ago this time. If abortion were banned, you go back to a position like they had where they would perhaps go to illegal places, Mr. Trump said, inarticulately, but correctly noting that some women would be driven to back alley providers. That's always the sinister way that they try to twist this debate at the beginning, the middle, and the end of their argument here. But based on what we've seen, if the court were to actually do this, it would then go to the state level. And obviously the ones that are deep blue would probably make it legal, right?
They certainly would. And that would be, you know, as of right now, I think only about 20 states have a 20-week abortion ban. So I don't think there would be suddenly some kind of harsh, you know, restriction against abortion all across the country. That would be nearly impossible to pass at the federal level. And I think that pro-abortion or pro-choice people know that, but they prefer to use this kind of, you know, scare rhetoric, to use their language, I guess, to try and frighten women into thinking that reversal of Roe v. Wade would just mean no abortion anywhere.
How scared are they on the pro-choice side, Alexander? Because you cover this issue a lot and you consistently point out the polls, particularly during the 20-week abortion ban debate, that most Americans, even if they consider themselves pro-choice, believe there should definitely be restrictions like those against late-term abortions. And the Democrats and the media just conveniently ignore that. So how scared are they that when they see the actual numbers that they don't report, that they see the tide turning against them?
I think they're very concerned, particularly because, you know, they're huge allies. The pro-choice movement can't really get very much done without legislation, without the Democratic Party protecting them. And right now, Democratic politicians are almost entirely united in lockstep protecting unlimited abortion rights. But to the extent that this polling continues the trend in a pro-life direction, you know, as you said, even people who consider themselves Democrats or consider themselves pro-choice, 75% of Americans are in favor of at least some restrictions on abortion, whether that be limiting it to the first trimester, you know, limiting it to before 20 weeks, things like this. These are widely supported across the country. And so to the extent that politicians on the left start to notice that and feel like that might, you know, harm their position in some way, I think you could very easily see them tracking more to the middle on this issue. And the pro-choice movement obviously would lose some crucial support.
A week ago today was primary day in Illinois. And in addition to the governor's race there, the big focal point was the Democratic primary in the 3rd Congressional District. You went out and actually covered that. It focused on incumbent Democrat Dan Lipinski, who's held that seat for a number of years, but he's pro-life. He voted against the Obamacare legislation as a result of that. And so a lot of folks on the pro-choice side, NARAL, Planned Parenthood, pumping a lot of money into that race for his challenger, who ultimately came up just a bit short. So is this a reprieve for the pro-life Democrat? Are they still on life support? Is this going to give oxygen to some of the challengers in some of these other races who are going to be presenting themselves as moderate Democrats to have a spot in the party? Or is this just a matter of time before the pro-life Democrat is an extinct species?
I think it really, for right now, it is only a matter of time, because Lipinski is one of just maybe three Democrats in the House who consistently vote in favor of pro-life legislation. There are even fewer in the Senate who are consistent on the issue. Maybe one. I don't know if any of them are really fully consistent on the issue being anti-abortion. And so I think you know, for right now, the Democratic Party very clearly is pro-choice and pro-abortion. I don't think that will be the case forever, both because of these polls and just because of, you know, the trends in science and technology. I think it'll become impossible to deny the humanity of the unborn. But at least for the foreseeable future, I'm pretty sure that the pro-life position will not be welcome in the Democratic Party.
Doesn't seem like it. If there's any litmus test stronger than the pro-Roe v. Wade on the Democratic Party, I'm not sure there is one. Howard Dean said as much shortly after the 2016 election. There's just not room for pro-life Democrats anymore. So I know where they're welcome.
We're waiting with open arms.
Yes, exactly. Alexandra, always good to be with you. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Good to be here, Greg.
Alexandra DeSanctis of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus. Thanks so much for being with us. Follow all of us on Twitter. He's at Jim Garrity. I'm at Dateline_DC. She is at Zan, that's X-A-N underscore DeSanctis. Also, if you're enjoying the podcast, give us a nice review over at iTunes and tune in again Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.